Hello, everyone. I'm going to talk about HydraFS, a file system that we built for the content addressable storage system that we built at NEC. This is older work that at NEC Lab, and meanwhile, some of my co-authors moved to other companies. So the requirements for the system was to have a scale-out storage solution that has global deduplication, uses content-defined chunking, resilient to multiple failures, easy to manage, self-healing and other self-properties, high throughput. But the high throughput was absolutely essential for streaming access. And we wanted to have standard interfaces so that it can be a drop-in replacement for other storage solutions. So the system comprises two layers. One is this content addressable block store that provides the scalability, ease of management, resilience, has high throughput, but it has this content addressable API, which is not easy to use by different applications. This work has been described last year in the HydraStore paper. The access layer provides the standard protocols so that, as I said, the appliance can be served as a drop-in replacement. And it has to have, to allow the high throughput that is achievable by the block store to be seen by the application, and is also responsible for the content-defined chunking. So this talk presents HydraFS, and in the next talk, Eric is going to present some of our ideas for bimodal chunking to improve the duplication. Let me start by providing a flavor of how the block store behaves. So the API supports variable size blocks. So the boundaries of the blocks are decided by the file system. The block is written in the block store. And the block store decides the address that through which this block is going to be accessible. So the address is derived from a hash function, but the fact that the block store decides the address also allows the paranoid check that in that if somehow there is a collision, if the actual contents it can be compared so that a different address is returned in spite of the fact that it was a hash collision. This check is not enabled in the product, and we have not yet seen any collisions. The file system produces another block. It writes, it had many concurrent writes to the block store. And as I said, the duplicate elimination is done by the block store. So the file system just writes blocks and receives content addresses back, and whether the blocks had identical content or not is decided by the block store. Another feature is the fact that the block store supports configurable block resilience per block level. So, for example, the file system might choose to write file system metadata with higher resilience than file data. Eventually, an address is returned, and the file system writes a so-called root block, and this allows the block store to support garbage collection. So the requirements for the file system application is to indicate which blocks need to be retrieved with a file system chosen key, so that in case the file system crashes, all the data can be retrieved without having to store content addresses somewhere else. So the outline of the rest of the talk, I'm going to talk about the challenges posed to the file system by this kind of block store device, the file system architecture, techniques used to overcome challenges, and some conclusions. So let me start with the challenges. So the content addressable block store has this nasty feature that the change in the block contents also changes the block address. And this bubbles up to the root of the file system. This is seen in other like no override file systems. In this case, there's an extra complication in that the parent can only be written up that the children's writes are successful, because the parent doesn't yet have an address before the write is successful. Another challenge is the fact that we have this country-defined chunking, which produces variable-sized blocks. So the block boundaries change when the contents change. This complicates a lot overwrites, because you have to have a like read, rechunk, rewrite process. And of course, like indexing variable size chunking is slightly more complicated than fixed size blocks. And the last one, which whereas the first two are kind of common for contentable storage, the third one comes from the fact that our block storage is distributed and with the high resilience provided by erasure coding, which causes the latency of the operations to be fairly high. And this exacerbates the first two challenges mentioned above. The file system has a fairly conventional persistent layout. We have data blocks that are shown in yellow. The metadata consists of B-tree. Directory contents, again, are indexed as a B-tree. And we have an inode map, which is a segmented array, again, indexed by a B-tree. Eventually, a file system superblock, which is the root block that I mentioned earlier, that we indicate the block store that this is a root. The architecture of the file system consists of these two servers, file server and commit server. They exchange control messages. The file server responsibility is to interface with the application. It writes data. At some point, writes the update log for the operations that are performed, and all the metadata that has been changed is cached in the file server. The commit server reads the log, produces the metadata, and writes file system root, which at some later point is read by the file server. The metadata is cleaned. The processing continues, produces more blocks. The commit server produces more metadata, and so on and so forth. Let's take a closer look at the file server. The file server has several important data structures. One is the write buffer that accumulates written data. It's flushed on sync. I also like to mention the fact that we notice that a lot of NFS packets arrive out of order. So this, the fact that we buffer these writes also helps with trying to smooth out to avoid having gaps in the sequence, which again is complicated by the fact that we have this content-defined chunking. So chunking in the presence of holes becomes, again, more complicated. We want to avoid them. We buffer this write so that any late NFS packet arrives so that we can have the streaming chunking that perhaps is used by a backup application. So the chunker is the one that decides block boundaries. And as I said, this is based on data content. And the metadata, the dirty metadata, again, is kept in memory. So in this case, like there are three subclasses. One, file system file modification. You need to keep the file offset range to content address. Directory modifications, like addition removals. And inode map modifications, which consist of like allocations and deallocations. This gives rise to a very large amount of dirty metadata, and this requires very efficient cleaning and introduce some resource management issues, and I'm going to talk about some techniques to solve these kind of problems. And the last data structure is the block cache, which just it's a hash, it's a dictionary in which the keys are content addresses, and the data are the data blocks that have been written to the back end. Note that the write buffer contains only dirty data, the metadata modification records only dirty metadata, but the block cache contains only clean, both data and metadata. So we keep metadata unserialized. So this kind of simplifies the resource management. Let me go into the write processing to give you an idea of how this works.
So
So write comes to the file server, is buffered in the right buffer. Another write comes, it so happens to be sequential. When enough data arrives at the right buffer, the chunker decides a boundary. In this case, it was a boundary after 12K of data. It's written in the back end. The back end replies with the content address. And the file server keeps in this metadata modification records a record that a block with from offsets from 0 to 12K has been written. The content address is CA1, which this data can be retrieved from the block store in case somebody wants to read it or override. And it's also annotated with a timestamp to allow cleaning. As more data comes in, more chunks are going to be produced, more modification records accumulate in this dirty metadata part of the file server. Eventually, when the file server accumulates enough modification records, it writes a log block, which is processed by the committer, as I explained before. Let's take a quick look at the committer. The first observation is that the committer does not need to read data. All it needs is to read the log that already contains the content address of the data block. There is no reason to read the data block themselves. It just, based on the offsets that contain the modification records, it can build the metadata. This very naturally allows the system to have multiple versions, and this is something that we can easily build, but because we want it to be a simple drop-in replacement, this was not an essential feature, and we have not yet decided exactly how to sort of expose these past versions. I just want to mention that the commit server amortizes the updates over many log records, not just one. And the question is exactly how many. And there are two limits to exactly how much the commit server keeps dirty metadata in memory. One is decided by the recovery time. So the recovery time is the time that we need to reapply the log. So the other reason for the commit server to produce a new root is that it all this memory is consumed and needs to flush out some dirty data and produces a new root. So as I said, the fact that there's a lot of dirty data accumulated in the metadata on the file server requires an efficient cleaning mechanism. And this is one of the techniques that have been used to deal with this problem. So coming back again to the file server, we have this file modification records for three inodes and the block cache that contains clean data. And the last super block read had this timestamp 779. So suppose that the committer produces a new root with timestamp 802, and it sends it to the file server so that it can clean its dirty metadata. The file server reads the new super block and evicts the old one, after which processes dirty inodes one by one. So the first case that happens for inode one is that the timestamp that's coming from the committer is higher than the maximum timestamp for modification records in the inode. In each case, the entire inode can be evicted. And this is actually quite fortunate case because you don't have to do much work. And this is another reason why we accumulate dirty metadata for a large amount of time in the file server, because the longer we wait, the higher the chance that the committer produces a root that allows us to just throw away the inode. Another case is where you actually have some records that cannot be thrown out because they are more recent than the max is higher than 802, the timestamp that comes from the committer. In each case, we can only drop selectively the records that have timestamp less than that. And you also drop the content address, because otherwise, reads for offsets that are not shown in, they are not buffered in this, they are not dirty, have to be looked up in the cache. And if we start looking at the old root, we get old data. Because we evict this, the lookup has to start with the root. So the new metadata is going to be brought up in memory as necessary. The last case is when all the modifications are actually newer than the version produced by the committer. In each case, we just skip the processing, because all the modifications are newer, there's really nothing to be done. The address that is already cached there is good to go. So the important points are that, like, this metadata locks only one item at a time, so there's no need to lock the entire tree or anything like that, and it doesn't require any I/O to be done with the lock help. So let's look at read processing. Suppose that the read for inode 2, starting at offset 0 for a length of 8k, comes. We see that in the dirty metadata, inode 2 is present, but the offset, like the range 0 to 8, is not. So we have to look it up in the cache. The data is not there, so it has to be brought in. When we reach the level where the inode content address is read, we can cache here in the dirty records, after which the tree is traversed to get to the data block. As you notice, the path from the root to the data can be fairly high. If the latency is high, actually this might raise issues with the performance. Right? And the question is what? Well, we prefetch, right? But just prefetching is not that simple. There are two problems. One is, again, that the high latency requires fairly high read ahead, and in the face of multiple concurrent reads, that's not possible. The other is that there is poor cache locality for metadata. And I'm going to show two solutions that we use to solve this problem. One is that we separate data and metadata prefetch. The other is a weighted eviction policy for the block cache. So taking a look at this block structure, it's becomes clear that the time to prefetch data block varies by its position in B3. So let's compare the reading B2 after we read B1 with reading B5 after we read B4. So in terms of file offset distance, the distance is the same. But in terms of tree distance, it's quite different. In the first case, it's likely that we're going to have only one cache miss. And I say likely because there could be data duplication and the block might have happened to be in the cache. In the second case, we traverse a path that has metadata blocks that are very likely not in the cache. So we have like way more misses. So in order to solve that, we sort of prefetch metadata more aggressively than data, obviously. So hopefully we reduce to only one cache miss. The other problem is that this different access patterns for data and metadata, so there are three kinds of cases. One is that we have data blocks being read. These has clean pages but are pinned and the read completes. And they are looked up typically in a streaming read. They are looked up once, then unlikely to be needed again. Data blocks can be prefetched in which, again, the pages are clean, they are not pinned, and you should avoid evicting them before they are read. And the metadata blocks, they are looked up more than once, but with large duration between accesses. So since they are looked up more than once, we want to evict them, but we want to avoid evicting them. Looking up the cache operations, we do that by assigning different weights to data metadata blocks. So on insert, we assign a weight based on the block type. On lookup, we reset to the initial weight and make the block most recently used. And reclamation proceeds by evicting all blocks with zero weight and decreasing everybody else's weight with one. So let's go to an example. Suppose that the metadata block weight is 3 and the data block weight is 1. Again, reclamation evicts zero weight blocks and reduces the weight by 1. So suppose we have this 3, there's a little bit of data duplication inside the same file. And we start with the situation in the cache that's shown here on the right. And we want to continue reading the file. So we are at block B12. This is a metadata block, has a weight 3. It's introduced in the cache with weight 3. We read this left child. This is B3. It's since B3 was already there, I said it's reset to the weight of a data block. Then continue with B6. And suppose that like reclamation is starting now. So reclamation, we reclaim all the zero length block and decrease everybody's weight with 1. After we continue the process, reading again B15, B14 resets them to 3, B13, B7, and B8. So how the effectiveness techniques, I have here some numbers. Again, so to recap, the two techniques are prefetching metadata more aggressively than data, and having this weighted allow you to evict data more aggressively than metadata. So in this experiment, we read a large file, and the number of metadata misses decreased, and the throughput was increased about 50%. The other important techniques is resource management. They said there's a fairly high amount of dirty metadata accumulated on the file server, and you need to clean it efficiently while still allowing the file server to sort of serve new requests. For this reason, we manage the memory in like we have two big data structures. One is we have pre-allocated managed memory, which is split among areas for different kind of resources like pages, inodes, metadata modification requests, and log blocks. And unmanaged heap, which is not tracked, but we make sure that the number of objects that sits in this unmanaged heap is always bound by some object that exists in the managed pre-allocated memory. So to go to an example, I suppose we have a resource with total 10, and there is no event in the system yet. And the admission condition is that we have to have the requested plus reserved plus allocated being less or equal to total. We have event one being created. Based on the event type, this event requires four resources, and 4 plus 0 plus 0 is less than 10. The event can be admitted, and the reservation is bumped up to 4. Later, the event allocates 4 resources, which is allowed to because it's reserved 4, after which it completes. Note that like allocated memory can still remain allocated. For example, this was a read event, and we keep the clean blocks in memory even though the event has finished. The event's reservations are released, however. And another event is created. It requires 3 resources. We can admit this event. Later, it allocates 2. Another event is created that requires 3. In this case, the admission condition, reserved plus allocated plus requested, is actually less than total, so this event is blocked. Another event comes. This actually has very little resource requirements, and actually this requirement exists in the system, but because we have FIFO processing, this is not admitted. Eventually, event 2 frees 2 units of memory, and whenever there are like free operations, the admission condition is reevaluated, and in this case, this event can be admitted, but the next event can still not be admitted. Event 4 remains blocked. However, when an event completes, we can reevaluate the admission condition, and eventually event 4 can be admitted as well. So the reclamation happens by first freeing all the free pages from the clean from the cache. And if it's not sufficient, we initiate the flush of dirty inodes. The flush is an internal event that has pre-reserved resources. Reclamation is initiated when event is blocked, as I said earlier, but this is a bit late, so you want to initiate it as soon as possible, and we use thresholds for that. And the threshold depends on whether the cleaning can be done by an update coming from the commit server. It takes a long time to actually get one of that, or whether it can be cleaned locally by flushing dirty pages. To have a sense of how well this resource management works. Well, first, the advantage is that we limit the amount of memory used. So one, you can easily avoid swapping. In terms of engineering, it avoids the headaches of having to deal with allocation failure in the middle of the event processing. As I said, we avoid event starvation through FIFO processing, because it's simple but effective, because it allows high utilization of resources. And I'm showing here an example where you have a streaming write. And with in blue is shown the amount of memory allocated, and in red the amount of the memory reserve, and in black the total. So the utilization remains fairly high through that. Putting it all together, I'm showing here a comparison with what is the performance of the block store. And so the point of the file system, the work on the file system was such that to avoid it being a bottleneck. So we wanted to be as close as possible to the block store. But before that, like how exactly do you modify, how do you measure the performance of the block store? So we have a tool that submits requests as much as possible until the block store reports busy. Eventually, the block store is going to reply that it can resume request submission, and the tool in this way has maximum amount of concurrency. It doesn't have any partial. So in a sense, it's an upper limit of the performance that can be obtained by the file system. So I'm showing here one read experiment where there's like no duplicated ratio and multiple write experiments in which the duplicated ratio increases. The block store performance increases because it has less data to write as there are more and more duplicates. And as you can notice, the file system actually achieves a fairly high percentage of the throughput afforded by the block store. So to conclude, building a file system for condensable storage poses a lot of interesting challenges. In our case, we use a small number of techniques that are sufficient to overcome most of them. We still have work to do on the read. And in future work, we want to provide a distributed implemented file system so that the metadata, dirty metadata, can be spread over multiple file servers, and to improve the performance of metadata intensive workloads by using SSDs. So with this, I'll leave it to the questions.
Hi, I'm Michael Kondik from NetApp. So if I understand correctly, your caching and keeping track of blocks of files is based on 4K byte pages, but you are forced to do I.O. or have chosen to do I.O. based on variable length chunks, content-based chunks, right?
The block store offers us a library to which we access blocks, right? So it's always, we supply the content address, the block store returns the block, and it's variable size, as you said.
But isn't this a pretty big impedance mismatch? So for each...
In our case, not, because the blocks are fairly large. They can be configured, but we are using between 32 and 96K blocks. So in this case, the internal fragmentation that you are mentioning is actually...
I'm not talking about fragmentation. I'm talking about complexity. What happens if someone writes into the middle of a file, thereby changing the chunk boundaries?
Right. I have not talked about that. It is a complication. The product was meant for backup. We want it to be correct for all sorts of operations, but performance-wise, the streaming access was the one that needed to be optimized. So that case is handled. We just flush or any data that is there, and we read, re-chunk, and rewrite.
But can the re-chunking that goes on extend arbitrarily far down the file, or is it guaranteed not to go beyond a certain point?
So if you think of the range of the overwrite, it can affect one and maybe two blocks to the left or the right, but not more than that, because this content-defined chunking is actually, this is one of the advantages of using content-defined chunking, in that you can localize any modifications that happen in a stream.
Okay, thanks.
Using the speaker once again.